you're at a public place and you grab your phone so you appear busy or in demand or important. That's FOPO. FOPO is staying late at work because your boss is still around. It's laughing at a joke that you don't find funny. It's pretending that you know a song or a movie that people are talking about so you're not the oddball out. It's holding a cocktail at a party when you don't want to drink because you don't want to be the weirdo.
So you're at the bottom of the Grand Canyon for a week, and you have the Tao Te Ching and The Art of Seeing by Aldous Huxley. What do you learn about yourself?
Danny, you've done some homework. Oh, this is going to be so fun. Okay. Nice. Oh, my God. Like, I'm so stoked that you brought that up. Okay. So I was – let's set the stage. I was 18 years old, and it was a leadership type of thing, and they brought about 12 of us down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And there was one rule, which is you couldn't see anyone else for 7 days. And so we had our little own silo, little nook, if you will, in the Grand Canyon. And just, I didn't know where anyone else was. So I was by myself. This was back in, 1992 or three. Okay. So Tao Te Ching, which is obviously the quote unquote Lao Tzu's, work of writings. And what did I learn? I learned that silence is scary. I was a extroverted thinker, introverted feeler, busy playing a game as an 18-year-old kid to look good rather than, feel good. And I got to silence and I thought, what do I do? There was like, this is well before cell phones. So that was not the issue. But I didn't have anything other than to go inward or to deeply tune to the world around me. And it's hard to just sit and settle in. So I realized that there's a scariness to that. And then when you do it, it's like, oh my God, there's so much good here. Like it's, you tune to some things that you never knew were even within you or outside of you. So that part is really, I wish that everybody in my life that I know would have or might get to experience that 7 day type of thing. Or even shorter, maybe. Maybe it's 5 days or 3 days. So that's one thing I learned. The other thing I learned is that the Tao Te Ching is hard to understand. I don't know. Have you had the chance to read it by any chance?
Just bits and pieces.
It's so hard. Yeah, it's really hard. And there's so much rich insight embedded in the prose. I think it's a foundational book for most people. And I would recommend that if you're going to read it, you read it with somebody else or a couple other people, just to kind of, so you're not alone with it only. I also learned that it's really important to be able to respond to a crisis. So it was, I think, on our fourth or fifth day, kind of in a bit of a calm panic, the two guides came kind of whipping across everybody, and they came, basically rattled my tent, and they're like, hey, we got a massive snowstorm coming in. We've got to leave. And so so we hiked up the canyon in like it started raining and snowing, and it was getting slippery and messy and muddy, and they're goat trails basically. And so it was pretty heavy. So that was a little bit of a heavy moment as an 18-year-old kid trying to navigate that with a couple other 18-year-old kids. And so nothing bad happened, but that feeling of near panic from adults on goat trails that are slippery, muddy, and obviously sheer sides to it, that was a good thing to experience. And what else did I learn is that I think that there's a keyhole to spending time with yourself to be able to understand the deeper spiritual parts of life. And so that keyhole, I don't know another way to get to it other than that silent experience.
My bio for a long time was go inward to find the truth. And I think that what you experienced when you were 18 really helped you get to some sort of truth. What was the before and after like of you from that experience?
I don't think it was a lightning bolt. I don't know if I've had many lightning bolt moments in my life where it's like, bang, all of a sudden everything is fundamentally different. I hear that for people, and I don't know if what I experience is that. My wife, who I've been married to for 20-some years, and you know, we dated in high school, she loves to say how dramatic I am sometimes, but like, I just, so even if I am dramatic, like, I don't know if I had this moment pre and post. But if I just kind of cobbled some, like that phase of my life together, I went from not interested in learning in a traditional way. Like I'll be kind to myself, and I accidentally tripped into a 2-year college. Nobody in my family went to college, and it was my senior year, and my parents pulled me aside in our kitchen. We're in Southern California. I grew up surfing. The place I grew up was called Burnout Beach, just to give you an indicator of what happens to people that spend a lot of time there. They just burn out. And they pulled me aside, and I'm in my kitchen. I'm a young senior in high school. I started school a year earlier than others. And they said, look, Mike, we tried our best. And we didn't know how to navigate this next phase. We didn't do it ourselves. So they were hippies that dropped out and had kids young. And so I was born on a farm in Virginia with like running water during winter was like kind of a 50-50 ball. And we didn't know how to do it. And so they looked at me and they were like, serious though. They're like, you've got two choices. I was like, whoa, like life got serious. And they said, get a job and move out like now, or go to community college, go to a 2-year school, and you can still live here if you go to school. And I said, oh my God, like I am not ready at 17 to get a job and get out. And so I said, well, okay, I know I can surf and like fake the school thing. So maybe I can just buy another 2 years until I figure out what's next. And I didn't realize that those two professors that brought us to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, Dr. Zenka and Dr. Perkins, a philosopher and a theologian, and their best friend as well, Dr. Cusio, was a psychologist. Those three professors at this community college were like, they saw this scrappy little punk rock, you know, kid, surf punk kid, and they're like, huh, you got a little spark to him. He's a little bit of a wild one. And what if you learned about how, you know, your psychology worked and how like the spiritual thinking kind of works and like big ideas of philosophy? What do you think, kid? I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. They said, well, what are you into? And I said, I don't know, surfing. What about it? I said, like, it's a place that I can get in tune and be in touch and like do my thing. And like, I'm not bothered by anyone else. And if I make a mistake, like I get held under. And if I'm honest about like pushing right at the edge where I could get held under and da da, but I'm honest about getting to that messy edge, to that scary edge, then I get better. So I'm into getting to the messy edge and, you know, figuring it out on the fly that way. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. And so we just spent a lot of time that the four of us, they were so instrumental. So it was more about that phase of life where they said, let me show you the world of the, you know, the invisible part of the human experience. Let me show you what it's about. And from that point forward, Danny, I studied into remedial math, remedial English. Like I tested into that because I didn't do high school properly. I got a 0 on my SAT. And once I got through those remedial classes, which in and of itself I was embarrassed by, man, no one ever had to ask me to read another book on psychology, philosophy, or theology. You know, like I was hooked. And come to find out, like I liked the formal education process. And so I stayed as long as they would keep me. And I, you know, I went all the way, got my graduate degree in sports science, and then a PhD in psychology, and then licensed as a psychologist. So that moment was more about that arc, and that arc of like somebody seeing me saying, hey, let me show you something that I think you might be interested in. It just changed me.
When you were asked about those three mentors you mentioned, Dr. Cusio, Dr. Perkins, and Dr. Zenka, and you were asked, what did they teach you? And you said, they showed me how to love and to be fascinated by the invisible. Mm-hmm. And that to me just hit me. Like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. Wow. Like, mm-hmm. if there was ever something to study, if there was ever something to devote your life to, it would be to learn about love and learn about what we can't necessarily see. So,
You're on it. The most interesting things, the most powerful things in life are all invisible. And I know I say that to my biology friends, and I say that to my physics friends, and some agree, some don't agree. And like, I am bored by the concreteness of only the observable. I appreciate it. Like, I think there's so much more we need to learn about how things work. But that like, I'll give you an example. Like, one of the really interesting studies in psychology is they gave, they put out two milkshakes, and one milkshake said indulgent on it. And it was like a chocolate looking milkshake. And then another milkshake said sensey shake on it, like it's sensible. And the researchers said, okay, this indulgent shake, it's like full of fat. You're going to love it. It's amazing. It's so creamy and delicious. And like, this thing is indulgent now, and you're going to love it. Okay, then they measure the people taking, consuming that. And they measure a very specific peptide called ghrelin and how they metabolized it. And a couple days later, those same people came back to the study. And then they said, okay, now take this sensey shake. Again, the sensible shake. And they said, you know, this is healthy. This does a lot of good for you. And it's the same person a couple days later. It's the same shake, just different label, to be clear, okay? So then if I'm the subject and I'm drinking that shake, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, okay. Well, this isn't so bad. Yeah, it's maybe a little chalky. So I'm thinking that it's different, you know, in the way I'm experiencing it. But then the researchers, what they did is they measured, again, the same peptide, and people metabolized it differently just by the flipping idea that it's supposed to be healthy or supposed to be indulgent. Our bodies actually processed those raw materials that came in differently. That's mind-blowing. I mean, that just sits squarely in this idea that the beliefs that you hold about just about anything, and beliefs are invisible, the beliefs that you hold fundamentally change the experience that you're about to have. If you believe that people are selfish and out for their own self, and I guess that's the same thing, and are a little mean-spirited, and somebody cuts you off, you turn into like a defensive, aggressive, righteous, you know, protector of lane changing or whatever. And our whole system lights up that way. If you have a fundamental belief that most people are considerate and they're kind of struggling through life, and you know, most people are not rude. They just, there's a lot going on in people's lives. And like, if someone cuts me off, like, I don't know, I hope their grandmother is okay. You know, that you have a very different physiological experience on the same type of maneuver, you know, out on the street. So our belief systems are like really important. Come to find out, Danny, is that we can train our belief systems. We're not born with them. And so your parents, the house you grew up in, the street, the block, the neighborhood, the culture, the music, the poetry, the professors, the teachers, the, you know, like religion, no religion, like all of that shaped your fundamental beliefs before you were like 12, before you had your first pimple. The majority of your belief systems are baked and they're invisible. Holy shit, try to figure out a better life from that place if you had like some real challenges in the origins of your beliefs. It's hard. It's just hard. Working with the invisible is difficult. So difficult that how long has it been? I mean, I'll do, you know, modern philosophical approach, like the last, call it 100 years. I don't know, it's longer than that. We're afraid of psychology. Mm. That's for them over there. Now, that's no longer the case. Like, if you still have some or all of that inkling that psychology is for the weak, disorderly, the screwed up, like, you're still in the Stone Ages. You know, like, and I'm coming from elite sport. Elite sport right now, you go to any top tier program, psychologist is fully embedded in the program. And a step down, psychologists are meaningful embedded. Two, three steps down, our psychologists are at least in the building. But that's not happening in big business. That's not happening in the rhythm of family life. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this, for too many of us, there's this taboo around psychology. And I'm on a soapbox right now, so let me just kind of round this out, is that I needed this as a kid. And come to find out, there is a sub-specialty in psychology, which is the study of human excellence, of human flourishing. That's sport and performance psychology. It's the study of what it means to be at home with yourself wherever you go. And there's a difference between the philosophy of religious doctrine and the psychology that helps support you living, like, tuned and aligned to those deep philosophical positions when it's hard to do so. Last point I'm going to make. Clarity, last point right now, I guess. Clarity about your first principles is really important. That's foundational. And then to live with conviction about those first principles, that's special. Mm. And the greats, you pick one. When I ask you to think of five greats in your life, Danny, like, who comes to mind? People I would know.
Yeah, I'm going to go with your greats. I'm going to go with Gandhi, MLK, Jesus, and Mother Teresa.
Yeah, I mean, that's a masthead, isn't it? Okay, good. So you'll nod your head that those are special ones, right? So, like, if Mother Teresa was in this room with us right now, you know, because she's so powerful, she's got such conviction, she's got great clarity, I'm going to be in service of others. So that's her first principle, okay? I am going to organize my life to be in service for others. And then she has great conviction, so much so that, like, people were like, you're going to get sick touching those people with scabs. Like, you can't go into that town. That town's too dangerous. You can't go and touch those people. Like, you're going to get a disease. And she's like, look, I'm in service. I'm going to do the thing. And I believe I got someone on my, you know, it's got my back. I got God and Jesus. Like, they got my back. Let's go. And so she had great conviction. So what sits between clarity and conviction are your belief systems, okay, and the psychological skills of confidence, of calm, of clarity of how to move the ball forward, which is goal setting, of using your imagination to see a better, compelling future. That's imagery. So there's a handful of basic psychological skills that we can train. We can also train our belief system so that we can be of conviction from the first principles that matter so much to us. And again, let me finish the story. If, like, Mother Teresa were hanging out, if we were so fortunate to do that with her, you know what we'd be talking about right now? We'd be talking about, like, how are you servicing? How are you helping others? You know, and I feel like she'd have this dull stick in my back with these kind eyes and say, I think you can do better, sweetheart. You know, like, I just feel like I'd get that from her. I'd be like, yes, I can. And so I love the people that have clarity and conviction and have the mental skills to back it up in any room that they're in. Now, we can train, though. This is not left. We're not born that way, right? Like, we can train it. And I am concerned for, let's call it just the now generation. I am concerned because where do you learn these mental skills? Well, we used to learn them in the formal institutions of religion. And there's a deep mistrust that's taking place right now. And for good reason. Like, there's some systems that need to change. Like, I grew up in a Christian family, and we had monsignors and priests, and we had people at our house. My family was deeply in service of the church. But if there's an institution that is going to hide pedophilia, if there's an institution, like, and I know you care about this. I have a hard time with that. So I'm clouded right now that institutions have been corrupted, and I know why. And there's really good people inside institutions. We'll separate those two. But where do we go? Where are some people like me? Where are we going to learn how to condition and train and optimize our psychology to be in service of the beautiful first principles some of the greats have outlined for us, not all of us can afford to go to a psychologist. So where, seriously, Danny, like, help me out. Where do we go?
I think
where do people
right
go to train? Where? Here. Great. Let's do it.
I think it's what we are looking at right now is the modern day church in some sense. And
it almost feels blasphemous, doesn't it? Because I'm not qualified for that.
No, I understand. But where do people go to find information on how to live a better life? That used to be church. And
that's
today,
cool, man.
Today it's podcasts.
That's cool. That's crazy.
It is crazy.
You know what at least the those formal institutions had is a structural process to be credentialed that, you know, you can teach something and with some accuracy, where like in the world of the land of podcasts, you know, there's kooks out there.
Yeah.
You know, there's people, you know, there's some real nut jobs that are providing advice.
Well, this is one thing
I'm not sure is sound.
Yeah, I agree with that. But this is one thing I want to talk to you about, because it seems like you've had such amazing mentors in your life. Either you've been attracted to the right people or the right people have been attracted to you. You know, we mentioned Dr. Cusio, Dr. Perkins, Dr. Zenka. You also have Gary de Blasio, who played a pivotal role in your life as a mentor. And these relationships that you speak of so fondly on different podcasts show that you're in your career, you're building, but you also are giving credit to the people who have helped you and lifted you up. So the question becomes, how do you either become somebody that is capable of receiving guidance from people who are smarter than you, or how do you attract those people the right way?
Oh, that's cool. No one's ever asked me that, Danny. I think that I have a bit of a, I get a rash when someone's going to give me advice. Mm. Not because I know better. I know I don't know better. But the mentors that have been in my life are the ones that have made a commitment to see me and to try to understand what it's like to be me, and then hold a space for me to fall apart and to laugh and to cry and to get to some insights. And those are the ones that I'm like, there's something really special about it. I think the most significant decision we make is the person we're going to partner with, you know. And for me, that partner is my wife. And that is no joke, because that person, they're basically making public promise, like, I got you, you know, and I'm going to support you and I'm going to back you, and I'm going to hold a truth mirror up, and I'm not going to play the game of convenience and search for approval and manipulation of money and time. And like, I'm in it with you. And if that person's not aware enough to know what that means, well, there's going to be some trouble down the road. And if that person is just, you know, Machiavellian and they just want the good life because you are handsome or charismatic or whatever, and maybe you have lots of money, there's trouble coming. And that's why 50% of divorces happen in the United States. Like, we don't know what the promise is. So I think that it's not as much mentorship as it is relationships that care. And I have, at a young age, a real problem being vulnerable. And it's because I had to front a certain way to be okay. And I love my dad. I love my mom. My dad was, when I was growing up, struggled with addiction. And he would come home and he'd be the most fun, the most wonderful human you can imagine. My friends loved being around him. It was awesome. And sometimes he'd come home, and when he was coming down off of something, like, he was as irritated and agitated. So I had to figure out how to, like, check the pulse. I had to figure out how to, like, what am I getting? So I had to tune into, you know, the micro expressions, the early tells, so that I could adjust for a sense of normalcy, if you will, to take care of myself. So I didn't, and then my mom is codependent, as most drug addicts and codependents work well together. And So I never really got to the truth because she's like, oh, honey, you know, your dad just didn't sleep well last night. Bullshit. He's coming down from something or he's up on something. I don't know. And so, so I say that with like deep love and respect for my parents, but to make a point that I had to figure out how to pick up micro expressions. And what it ended up doing for me is I'm good socially, but at the cost of my authenticity. So I had to square up in my life, like how to do both. And the people that held a container that said, no, I really want to know you. I know that you've got some charisma about you, but I want to know you. And then I would say something, be like, yeah, that sounds good. What do you mean? Well, that sounds smart. What else you got? And I say something and they go, yeah, that sounds smart too. I'll wait. Wait for what? I'll wait until you start feeling what you say. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? Well, Mike, like we can do this all day long, but nothing really is going to go anywhere until your thoughts and words and feelings line up. So I'll wait. What do you want me to do, cry? Well, I mean, just feel what you say. All right. Maybe we talk tomorrow? You know, like, all right, if that's what you want to do, no problem, Mike. So like those types of like radical forces, and I'll tell you the way it feels for me. I'll tell you this story. This is a different mentor of mine. he ran the psychological practice at my PhD program. And so he was responsible for like creating the applied. So we're studying all the research on psychology, da da da. And then he was the one that says, right, this is actually how you do psychology. So he was holding that space. And I had this reputation going into grad school that I was already working with like, you know, all-star athletes. So I was like, that is what I'm doing. But what ended up happening is like I had this shield. It was almost like this false shield that I was good. I'm just doing my best now. But I had success, quote unquote, of working with top tier athletes. So there's this class where there's like 15 of us, and each of us had to go into the middle of the room. And it was a couple professors and the other, call it 13 peers. And one person had to be the therapist, and the other person in the middle of the room had to be the client. Okay, so you had to bring yourself and a real issue to the room. And it was the last day of class. And the professor, who I just really respected, he was a Vietnam vet. He came back with real scar tissue. He was a leader of men. He had intel coming in to say, hey, the Viet Cong are west. You know, go east. And his intuition and intel said, that's wrong. I hear something east. I can't go east. I don't hear anything west. So he turns the comms off, looks back at his team, and he says, okay, men, we're going west. And I mean, I just feel for him right now still, because I know his pain there. He was wrong. And I feel the responsibility too, not in the same way, of course, but like, maybe you feel this way in some respects, Danny, like when people are trusting you to help them and you don't make the right call, you listen to the intuition, you go somewhere and you take that step in leadership and you're fucking wrong. And mistakes are fine. No, don't. But mistakes that cost lives are a whole different magnitude. And I do work in some of the most consequential environments on the planet. And this is what keeps me up at night. Sorry, I'm feeling a lot right now, but this is what keeps me up at night is pouring in the right way to people when they make mistakes that people's lives are at stake. And so go back to this. So he came back, kind of had to do this deep work to shed all of the pain, shed the ego, shed. To strip the all the way down to the pure kind of wick of the bone, or wick of the wood is what I'm thinking, and then rebuilt layers and layers on top of it from beauty. And so he says, "Mike, you're up." And he says, "Nervous?" I said, "No, I'm good. Like, I just want to give everyone else a chance to go." And he kind of gives me this look, like this little twinkle. And he says, "Come on in. Which seat do you want to sit in, Mike?" And I said, "No, I'll be the therapist. No problem." And so I sat in the therapist chair. And he says, "Okay, Tatiana, you haven't gone yet." I'll never forget her name. She walks up, and I have this feeling. What is she going to say? I mean, she's my age. She's this wonderfully charismatic person. And she sits down, and obviously different genders. And I said, "Man, I hope this doesn't go somewhere like something traumatic that was like sexual for her. And I'm having these thoughts like, that would be crazy for me. Like, I would not know how to deal with it." And I can see she's nervous. And so I just kind of, I take a breath and I lean in and I say, "So what do you want to talk about?" She pauses and she checks, she looks, and she says to me, "It sounds like I'm making all this up, like revisions of history, but this is, I know she's checking to see if I'm okay." Hmm. And I'm starting to like really rattle at this point, but I'm hiding it. Like I said, I'm good at fake. I was, I'm no longer that good. I don't value faking anything anymore. And so she looks at me, she says, "I don't think you can understand this, but I was molested as a child repeatedly." This is a classmate. And I said, "I don't understand." And now I can feel my heat up. I can feel my body tense up. And I kind of like don't remember. I remember a little bit of the feeling, but I don't remember. And all I remember the next moment is that maybe it was like 3 minutes in. I must have been just laying eggs everywhere. And the mentor walks behind me, again, the head of the school. He grabs my shoulders in like this really nice, warm, strong way. And he says, "Mike, this isn't cool." I go, "I know, I just like," and he knew and I knew and everyone knew that I was a fucking disaster. And I was up in my head. And so he says, "Tatiana, thank you." He says, "You okay?" And she says, "Yeah, I'm good. Like you saw that she had to take care of herself. I didn't know what I was doing." So she's like, "I'm good." He says, can you just kind of scoot to the side for a minute? And then if you'd be okay, I'd like to process some of this with you, but I want to sit with Mike first." This is how bad it was, okay? So she goes, "No problem." And it was awesome what he did. So he says, "Right, Mike," and we're like knees to knees. And he says, "Mike, you're now the client and I'm your therapist." He says, "What's up?" I said, I don't know. He says, "What's up?" And so he was drilling in, and the way that it feels to have somebody who really cares sit in front of you and really care about you and your experience, it's like a lion. It's like the most, imagine the biggest mane, the gnarliest teeth, biggest claws, the most powerful resting lion right in front of you, looking right at you. And you can't quite tell if the lion's going to kind of stand up and rip the claws across you and kind of open your guts, or it's going to kind of say, "Come on in and snuggle," you know, or just like, "Let's hold that space right here. Like, are you a lion too? No? Huh?" You know, it's that type of power that person can create, that type of feeling and space of like, I'm scared and I'm safe. I got to make a choice. And like that type of experience, that's what mentorship is. It's holding the container of depth where they're never going to rattle. And they make a promise, and the way that they present that they're bedrock and you think you are, but you're not even close. Like, let's go somewhere. That's the type of space if you really want to help create change for people at the deepest level, we need that type of thing and feeling. On the other side, like there's so many transactional skills that we can develop. Those are mechanical. You can train the skills to be calm. You can train your mind to be confident. You can, there are trainable skills that are very mechanical and quite simple. It just requires, if you want to go in the gym and get stronger, Danny, like you got to put time under tension, right? Put a rack on your back. You got to like do the lifting. Sets and reps, right? Same for mental training. Rep, and set and rep and set. Like, it's the same thing. It's not that confusing. But so anyways, thank you, Danny. I'm back. Thank you for letting me go somewhere with you.
It's so rare that you get to hear someone's, like, the depths of someone's emotions when it's a virtual interview. And so I'm so appreciative for you for having the courage to go there, even though we're not in the same space together. I just want to say that.
Yeah.
When did you start feeling yourself to be more real and the truth start to come out in your life?
There was, like, my 30s were tricky, you know. I had this professional kind of momentum. I'm still kind of topping off my grad school. I'm all in, like, my nose is buried in a book, and I'm in high performing environments of sport, and I'm married. And my wife says to me, after 7 years of marriage, she squares up with me, you know, in a loving way, shoulder to shoulder, we're squared up, like, looking at each other. And she says, "I love you. You're a good human. And I've lost my way, and I don't feel like I can be me in this relationship. And it's not working."
Whoa.
I said, "What? What do you mean?" She goes, "Look, we've talked about this. This shouldn't be new." I go, "But it feels very different." She goes, "No, like, I can't keep saying it anymore." And so, you know, she says, like, you got to get out. We are done. And I was like, "Wait, hold on." She goes, no. I'm not saying this anymore. Like, I love you, and we need to end this. And if you don't want to move out, I will." And I was like, "Oh, I'm not going to have her move out to some apartment. Shit." You know? And so I say that because I've had these moments, and then I was numb to the, numbing myself to the connection to the person that I cared most about. And so now, as a psychologist, I know that moving out is like the first step to the death sentence of the marriage. Like, usually people don't move back in. You know, separation is usually exactly that, a separation. And so, sorry for the alarm, you know, out back here. So I move out. 2-3 weeks go by. I'm a disaster because I've screwed up the thing that matters most to me. Great. I've got a PhD. Great. I've got, you know, I'm doing sports psychology with pro athletes. What the fuck? And so I reach out to her. I'm like, "Hey, can we talk?" And she's like, I don't have anything to say." I said, "Let's try therapy. Please, let's just give that a chance." She goes, she said, "For you, okay." She goes, "I'm telling you, I'm done." So I said, "All right, I'm going to find a therapist that I don't know in the neighborhood. Let's just find somebody, and, like, I'll meet you there. I'll send you." Okay, no problem. So we show up, and she's Latina, I'm Italian by culture, and, like, we're screaming at each other. This wise woman therapist, you know, she's like 5 foot something, like, short in stature, and she stands kind of to the edge of her seat, and she goes, whoa. She says, "This is about as bad as it gets now." And she looks at us, and she says, "How do you want to do this?" I was like, "I don't know." And my wife is like, "I don't know." And so she says, "All right, look, we're going to stop here." We're halfway through our first session. She says, "The fact that you're fighting means there's a lot in here. Like, you have something for each other, but you're miles apart." She says, "I'm going to ask you one simple question. Do you want any rules during your separation?" I thought, oh my God, that's the question now, isn't it? Do you want any rules? You know what she meant, right?
No, what'd you mean?
Do you want to honor your vows? Do you want to date other people? Do you want to have sex with other people? Like, are there any rules? She said, "Do you want any rules?" And my heart sunk. I that's not what I was into. It's not what I hope she wasn't into. But I, listen, I was being too so selfish and da-da-da-da. Like, I had to just vulnerably look and wait to see how she responded. And I did not want to influence at all, so I didn't make any eye contact. And so she says, I'm not trying to get laid. I was like, oh my God, thank God. You know, that's not, you know, like, and I tell the story to my friends, quote unquote, right afterwards, like as I'm like crying in my soup, and they're like, dude, you had a chance. This could have been your hall pass. I'm like, you're fucking out of your mind. That is not like where I'm at with this at all. And so I'll tell you what, Danny, it made it so, it's complicated trying to figure out a marriage, and certainly while separated. And exponentially harder when you've got these other complicated kind of narratives around it. I am so, we're back together. The Journal of Excellence, there's an actual journal called the Journal of Excellence, came down and researched, used us as research about how we can do this or how we did it.
Wow.
And we figured it out. We thread the needle.
How?
And how? Okay. So we went to therapy once a week and we started to scream at each other less. And the therapist was magical in that she was grounded and science-based, and she did not presume that she would ever hold an answer for us. So she asked questions. And another foundational question that she said is, she said, okay, this is a different day. She says, so the first one was rules. And then so at one point, again, we were arguing in front of her, and she says, wait, hold on. Mike, do you think you have work to do? I was like, yeah, I got work to do. And she looks at Lisa, my wife. She says, do you think you have work to do? She's like, yeah, I got work to do. She goes, okay, big question now. Do you want to do the work with someone else, or do you want to do the work with each other? I don't know. I can't tell. And I was like, oh my God, here's another, that's another one. Oh shit, it could all be over right now. And so, you know, now at this time, I can't help but look, and I've got these big doe eyes, like with this intensity with it. And I look over at my wife and she goes, I want to do this work with you.
Wow.
I said, fuck, I've got a chance.
How long was that?
Like, I've got a chance. That was like after maybe like 2 months, 2.5 months of work. 7 years of marriage, a month separated, you know, a couple months of weekly sessions. And then, so then we just kind of got on the same page. Like, what are the work we need? What's the work I need to do? What's the work she needs to do? How do we do support each other in that work? And we just saw each other once a week for, I don't know, 5-6 months, something like that. Honored our vows, bang, check. And then we went on a date night. Actually, it was electric. You know, it was awesome. And then we went on a couple more date nights. And it was like we fell in love again. We had all of that kind of great, wonderful buzz of, you know, of an early relationship with all this kind of wonderful baggage that we brought into it. And we've been married 30-some years. And, you know, so anyways, I don't know why we're talking about this, because I'm supposed to tell you about the science of high performance and, you know, I'm going to tell you about my new book and like, sorry, Danny.
No, this yeah. is the second time you've apologized for your feelings or explaining something, but there's nothing yeah, to apologize man. For.
I appreciate you. Yeah.
The reason why we got on this thread was about how you started being the real you.
Yeah, it was through that process.
Gotcha.
That was where like the vulnerability really struck, and I don't think there's a way through anything that's interesting or compelling or any version of yourself if you don't pass through vulnerability on a daily basis. And that is what separates the greats. That's what separates athletes from non-athletes. That's what separates athletes for the most part and those of us not in athletic as a primary pursuit. Because athletes, what they do every day, they've made a fundamental commitment to be their very best. They go to work. And they've agreed to have coaches hold a standard to figure out a way to propel them to the messy edge where they're not good at something. Mm-hmm. And that coach can fire them. That coach is responsible to build them. Their peers will roll their eyes when you're not very good at that messy edge and you can't get it done game day. So there's a vulnerability and a real consequence when you're not good in that messy edge. So the vulnerability to get to the edge, not being good in it, and then figuring out how to cobble all that together and perform on demand when the lights turn on, if you will, it's hard. It's hard for your peers to critique and judge and coach you, and silently or publicly. And it's hard for another adult, you know, head coach, assistant coach, position coach, to publicly like say, that's not good enough. Come on, Danny, like how long do we have to talk about this? I've told you a half step. Why do you keep taking, you know, two steps? Like this is, I don't know if we can get this done, Danny. Like you've got to figure this out. I don't know another way. Okay. And to stand there with dignity and humility and vulnerability and a radical commitment to sort it out, that's what athletes do in practice every day, that I have such a high regard for how they organize their life to be about it in that way. Where the rest of us, our first principles, I'll make a bold statement right now. Most people's first principles are to be accepted, to not be rejected by other people. And that shows so evidently when you ask people their greatest fear. How would you respond to what you think most people's greatest fears are, Danny?
The fear of death or the fear of public speaking are the first things that come to mind.
Yeah, death is not the one for most people. It's public speaking. And there, by the way, there's far worse things than dying. There are far worse things than public speaking. So let's square up with the public speaking one. The reason that public speaking is one or two on the list, let's say, is because it is such a dangerous feeling to present yourself in a vulnerable way on a 3-foot riser on a stage in front of whomever, because if they reject you, hundreds of thousands of years ago, rejection from the tribe was a sure death sentence. It's too complicated once you're out of the fray to hunt, to forge, to gather, to build a tent, or a place to be safe, to ward off, you know, hostile people or animals. Like it was a death sentence. So we are deeply attuned to the potential opinion of another person, and we contort and we conform and we do whatever we can to be liked. We manage our impression to be accepted rather than know the first principles and flat out be about it, even at the cost of getting kicked out of the tribe, because the ancient brain has not been properly managed by the psychology of the mind. And if we don't invest in one psychology, the brain will win. It's been passed down for hundreds of thousands of years. Your great ancestry figured out the dark ages. They figured out how to be safe enough, belonging and safety. They figured out how to manage the wildebeest and the saber tooths and the, you know, like it's in your DNA for survival, Danny. And unless you work with your mind and go into the world in the invisible, your brain's going to win. And that brain is saying, stay safe, be okay. You know, make sure you don't get kicked out now. Why go on stage and risk it all? Like, okay, maybe you're going to get more money. Okay, so there's a risk in here, as opposed to like, no, get on stage, it's an opportunity. When you really train yourself and you really work from the inside out, the first rule of mastery is the name of the book. And the first rule is to work from the inside out, to invest in your own psychology. You start to see opportunities as opposed to everything being a threat. And that's the fundamental difference, opportunity versus threat. And until you work with your own psychology, most things, you're tuned to most things being a threat versus an opportunity. And again, that's trainable.
You know, you've said before that you were late to figure out who you were. You cared so much about what other people thought of you, and you were consumed by the perspectives of everyone else. And I assume that is what led to your first book coming out November 7th, The First Rule of Mastery, Stop Worrying About What Other People Think of You. It is the biggest issue in today's modern day and age. I talk to so many people who are worried what other people are going to think. I mean, I heard someone tell me not too long ago that they were scared to write what they truly felt in their own journal because what if someone read it? And what if, you know, a long time from now people brought that up? And how sad of a state is it that sometimes we can't even be honest with ourselves and our own journal because we're scared of what other people are going to think when they're not even reading it? It's madness.
But that speaks to how strong of a dictum the brain is operating from. I do talk about this research in the book that alarmingly so, a higher percentage than you ever imagine of people that go actually make the step and go to do therapy that they're lying to the therapist too. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't speak to the craziness of psychology. It speaks to the power of the dictum of the brain to be accepted. And until we square up with that, we'll never know what you're capable of. We will never know what the potential could be of you. And so I think about the book is that, first of all, I wrote an article for HBR, Harvard Business Review, and 12 months later they called and they said, hey, you know that article that we did? I said, yeah. They said it was the number one downloaded article over the last 12 months.
Wow.
Like you hit a nerve. And I was like, this thing about not worrying about other people, you know, like yeah. And so I said, and they said, can we write a book together? And I said, or can we be the publisher of your book? And I said, man, I'm wrestling alligators. Like I'm in this steep growth arc in this practice of taking the best of sports psychology and crosswalking that into best practices for businesses. And so I said, I can't do it right now. And they said, okay, we'll come back. Another 12 months go by. So it's now 24 months. They said, hey, we re-released that article. It was the number one downloaded article again. Let's come on now. And I said, let's go. I'm a great time. And so it hit a nerve. I think you're right that it's in there. I was embarrassed about it for so long. And the athletes I spoke with, like they feel it. The coaches I work with, the leaders of multinational corporations and entrepreneurs, they feel it. So of course artists feel it. Here's the way I think about it is that David Foster Wallace, you know, great poet and writer, and he says, he creates the story about two young fish swimming and there's a elder fish swimming in the other way. And that elder fish nods and says, morning boys, how's the water? And the two young fish, you know, swim on for a little bit. They don't say anything. And eventually one of them looks over to the other and says, what the hell is water? So the older fish's question, you know, how is the water? It was meant to make the young fish think about their own reality and the things that are so ingrained in their experience that they fail to notice them. It's the FOPO, fear of people's opinion, is the water that we swim in. It's the air that we breathe. It's like the Sixth Sense, the movie. Once you recognize it, like ghosts are everywhere. It's that type of thing. Like FOPO is everywhere. And my job is to help people become better. And this is the thing that I found that keeps them stuck is this pervasive fear of what are they going to think of me? And I think some of the most important realities for life are hidden in plain sight. And this is one of them. And FOPO is the water we swim in. It is, like I said, the air we breathe. And so I also love David Foster Wallace's insight because the two fish that were swimming, they didn't immediately look at each other because they didn't want to look stupid. They wanted to kind of pretend like, oh yeah, the water's good. So that's what we do when someone tells a joke and we don't get it. We laugh. Ha ha ha. That's FOPO. You know, FOPO is like when you're at a public place and you grab your phone so you appear busy or in demand or important. That's FOPO. FOPO is staying late at work because your boss is still around. It's laughing at a joke that you don't find funny. It's pretending that you know a song or a movie that people are talking about so you're not the oddball out. It's holding a cocktail at a party when you don't want to drink because you don't want to be the weirdo. It's avoiding a reunion or a social event because, you know, you think that they think you should have achieved more in your life. Like, it's everywhere. And it's hiding your age. You know, if you know that the company values youth, like, it's everywhere.
Quick
it's
story.
Exhausting.
Yeah, quick story on that. I mean, I order burgers with just the burger and the bun, no lettuce, tomato, onion, plain. And I give the order to my waitress one day, that's my order. And she said, you know what? I always wanted to order that way too, but I'm scared. And I'm like, it's just the way I prefer food. I mean, yeah, it's a boring meal. It's easy to make fun of, whatever, but that's the truth of what I want. And
so where does FOPO show up for you? Where does this little slippery filter for how you say, dress, think, do, like, how does it show up for you?
I would say it probably has to do with my exercise habits.
Yeah.
I don't know if I fear other people's opinions. I know, like, lifting weights and running are the two modalities that I'm really interested in right now, and I've been lifting since, you know, in the last 5 years. But I think about that a lot. Is like, how much of those activities are because of other people? And if it was a different time and a different place, I'd be doing something else. And I don't know if that's a fear or just like being part of the culture. It could be the water in which I can't even see. So what do you think about that?
I think it's in there. You know, like, there's part of you somewhere that's like, when you put on a shirt and you're like, oh, my guns look good in this one. Oh, my stomach looks a little too big in this one. Or, oh, like, does this make me look short? Like, I bet that's in there. And those are all like ways to manage your impression that you're presenting to other people. Mm. And you could be free. My next book will be to interview you to understand like how have you done it? And essentially that's what we did in the book, is we use good science to say, there's all these slippery little on-ramps to FOPO, and there's ways to get off of it. Even the greats like Beethoven had it. The greatest musician, composer of all time, potentially. You know, do you know anyone that doesn't know bum, 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 mm-hmm. You know, Symphony No. 5?
It's part of our culture.
It's part of it. Do you know that he created Symphony No. 5 under this psychology that he went away? He left his communities. He went and kind of hid out for a couple years because he was so terrified that people were going to think less of him because he was losing his hearing. Of all people, how could somebody as perfect as me lose their hearing? And so this is deconstructed from his writings. And he went away. And it said that great work of art, Symphony No. 5 from Beethoven, happened because he couldn't hear the music. And he was so attuned to like what was happening outside of him and all the opinions of other people that he had to go away, and that he couldn't quite hear the music like outside. So he had to listen to the music inside, which is like a new skill for him. That bum, 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 bum comes from him pounding his hand on his fist on the piano. Why can't I hear this?
Wow.
But it was actually, you know, and then he heard it as the story goes, and he's like, oh, that's interesting. Bum, 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 bum. So like, when you really embrace what's up for you and you work from the music from within and not create for the approval of others, you might just create the greatest masterpiece ever. You might create something that changes your family arc, you know, like your legacy of your family of a different way. My parents passed on genetic genes, some amazing, some suspect. And I'm just trying to make different mistakes and maybe upgrade the genetic coding and the environmental influences that I'm having for my son. So I don't know. I just love the idea that we can do better. And I think this is a little bit of the water that we swim in.
Well, I'm really excited to check out the book when it's
out. Thank
you,
brother.
The First Rule of Mastery, Stop Worrying About What Other People Think of You. Before I let you go, I have to ask my final closing question, which is about a challenge. We talked for the past hour. People listened for the past hour. What are you actually going to do with the information that we have talked about? What's a challenge that comes to mind that you can leave someone listening with?
Oh, I think have a conversation with somebody about FOPO and, you know, ask them, you know, do you worry about what other people think you? And stay in the water just a little bit longer, because it takes a little bit to get underneath the surface, you know, to get to that vulnerable, like, yeah, sometimes here and sometimes there. And so it'd be awesome if there's a twofold. One is if you did that. The second is, you know, there's a way that you can start your days off. to give yourself the best chance of having the quote-unquote good life. And it'd be awesome if folks wanted to know a little bit more about that. Like, I'm happy to send over a little audio guide on a morning mindset routine that is evidence-based. It's within, you can do it within 60 to 90 seconds, and it specifically primes particular parts of your brain network to give yourself a chance. And so if folks are interested in that, I'm happy to support a little challenge on that way. And you can just send an email to info@findingmastery.net, and in the subject, just put morning mindset routine, and we'll send it out to you.
Anywhere else we should stay connected with you?
I appreciate that. Social media is fun. You know, that's it's a good little way to communicate. So that's all those handles are at Michael Gervais, and Gervais is G-E-R-V-A-I-S. And then, of course, the Finding Mastery podcast would be kind of ground zero for everything for us.
Thank you so much, Doctor. Really appreciate you and your wisdom and the way in which you have continued to look at yourself time and time again, and you've used those lessons to help us live a better life. So thank you for being here.
Appreciate,
and thank you for the wisdom.
Appreciate you, Danny. Keep leading from the front. Thank you for creating the space and to have this conversation with you. And I really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Likewise.